This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Hammack. Today, I'm talking with a biologist about how in living things, size rules all. It determines a being's shape, speed, and even abundance. Our guest has written an elegant meditation on the subject called Why Size Matters, From Bacteria to Blue Whales. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Also, keep in mind that you can listen to WILL Live via the internet at www.will.uiuc.edu. So let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, John Bonner.
Hello.
John, let's start by just looking at the variations in size and without looking at some of the reasons for it. We'll get into the reasons a little later. And I want to look at the diversity in size that exists in our world. I mean, what's the smallest and largest among mammals, plants, birds, and reptiles?
Well, of course, you didn't mention bacteria. That's smaller than everything.
Anything. All right.
But, however, if you go to plants, then the duckweed, the small duckweed, is very, very small. And that's high of a higher plant, of course. And there is small algae, and there are so many small things. But if we're talking about respectable plants, then mm-hmm. the little duckweed is the smallest. If you talk about mammals or any kind of a vertebrate, then I think probably the smallest one is a small fish, which is, I don't know, about a centimeter long.
A centimeter long fish.
Okay. Excuse me?
A centimeter long fish?
Yes. In fact, it may be even smaller than that. I can't remember exactly, but it's amazingly small, and it has a life history which only lasts a week or so. So it really is a small beast.
And in mammals, what is the largest mammal?
Oh, well, the largest mammal, of course, is the blue whale. Mm-hmm. It wins everything. But in a way, a whale cheats because it floats in the water, so it doesn't have to hold itself up. Mm-hmm. The largest land animal is probably the prehistoric ones win. But elephants do pretty well. But if you look at something like Brontosaurus, which is a huge dinosaur, then it's bigger than the elephant by a great deal.
So let's look at some in invertebrates. I mean, what is the largest kind of animal without a backbone?
Well, I suppose the giant squid beats them all, and it is pretty big, 50 feet or so, depending upon how you measure it. So I think that probably is the winner.
So in your book, your main argument is that size determines everything about an organism, and I want to look at several ways that happens. For example, mm-hmm. what's the relationship between size and strength in an animal?
Well, the thing is that of course, the bigger you get, particularly if you're a land animal, you have to support yourself, and strength. Weight, what you have to support is a cubic dimension. In other words, pounds or anything is a cubic function of the length. But on strength, on the other hand, is a square function. So that you can think of it this way, and that is, if you have a biceps that's extraordinarily thick, that's exactly the way it should be, because the thicker it is, the more strength is there. And that's true of bones and everything. So cross-section area or squared function is strength, and weight is a cubic function. So the bigger you get on the weight, the more strength you need, or disproportionately big strength.
Well, let's take a look at what that means practically. Then what percent of say, weight is made up by bones in a wren or a mouse, and what percent is it in a human?
Well, I forget the exact figures, but the percent is very small in a wren or a mouse compared to what it is in a human being. And I once tried to find out exactly how much was the ratio of bone to weight in an elephant, and corresponded with a friend in India who is a great elephant expert. But I didn't get a satisfactory answer because it obviously is important how you measure it. The person who measured the Wren, I don't know how he did it.
Okay. So what you're saying here is that strength determines shape, or size rather determines shape because of the strength needed. That's
the underlying bones,
the muscles, and so on that are needed. Now, one of the things you do in the book very well is you look at some races that Gulliver's Travels ran into.
Yes.
And could you tell me the two races he ran into? And let's talk about using that strength versus weight ratio. What are they even possible?
Well, it's very nice. I'm very grateful to that book because it illustrates perfectly what is not correct. Namely, that Gulliver is a normal human being. So I estimate he's something like 5'8" or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. Lilliputians are a twelfth of the length. So that means there's something about a size of a mouse, and they don't weigh very much. And so they don't need as thick a limbs as a human being to support them. But the best is to go to Gulliver's Giants, the Brondagnonians, who I never can pronounce or remember.
Well, I could not say that when I was reading the book. So you said Brondagnonians?
Something like that.
Well, we'll use that.
Plus or minus a few syllables.
Right.
And actually, they're 12 times longer, 12 times taller. So they would have to have legs that look like elephant legs if they wanted to support that great weight. And so in this case, it's a good illustration of the fact that that weight determines your proportions because weight goes up as a cube and strength goes up as a square.
So your argument here is that if these large race existed, they would weigh some 12 tons. Right,
yeah.
And that you can't just simply scale directly. It's going to have to change in shape to be able to support that.
Exactly.
So, does this also explain why a human baby has different proportions than an adult?
Than
an adult.
Oh yes. Well, I'm not so sure about that because I think probably a small child is a different proportions from an adult.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that that has so much to do with the strength-weight problem because I think the child is well within the limits and there's no problems. They have a certain amount of ability to vary. And I think that the proportions of children to adults comes more from the rate of growth of the different portions of the body and they're all within a safe margin.
Okay. So you're also arguing that this size and strength determines a lot of the functions of an animal. I mean,
yes.
Is this the reason that a fly and a gecko can walk up a wall but a human can't? I mean, what's the fundamental reason for that?
No. It is true that the gecko can do it because it's small, mm-hmm. but the real trick there is that it has foot pads which have tiny little hairs at the bottom of the feet, in other words, the sole of their feet. And those little tiny hairs can touch everything the whole surface it's on, in intimate detail, because it has so many little things probing into the cement or whatever it is that the gecko is walking on. And the forces between the feet hairs and the cement are determined by how much of the cement is covered by the hairs.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have lots and lots of hairs, therefore lots and lots of contact points, the cohesion between the foot and the wall is very high. But if you took a gecko and put shoes on it so that it didn't have those hairs, it would fall off the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely, in that case, cohesion. But, of course, there's a limit because we could get the fanciest shoes in the world with millions of hairs on it, and we still couldn't walk up a wall because we're too heavy.
Mm-hmm. So let's now take a look at how living beings get their energy. I mean, part of it's through respiration, that is taking in oxygen. As a being changes his size, does this need for respiration force a change in shape?
Oh, no, I didn't quite hear you. What changes in size?
So a being, as a living animal. So we need a general term to cover everything from bacteria to animals and others here. What term would you use for that? I was using being.
Oh, that's fine. I call them all beasts.
Beasts. All right, we'll live with beasts. So as a beast changes in size, does the need to take in oxygen, does that change its shape and how it looks?
Oh, yes, it very, very definitely does. And if you measure the lung capacity or the gill capacity and plot that against the weight or the size of an animal, you'll see that the bigger the animal, the greater the surface of the oxygen capturing surface is in the lung or the gill. So that's just true of the gut too. A very small animal like a nematode worm has just a simple tube, but we have an incredibly long intestine with all sorts of convolutions in the intestine to increase the surface. So that is. All those things that I've just said are size-related. The small can be very simple, but the larger you get, the surface has to get very, very much, has to increase greatly.
So what you're arguing here is that a very small cellular beast, to use your words, has a large surface area to bring oxygen in, and as the thing gets bigger, as we go to other types of animals, in order to be able to take the oxygen in, we have to develop all these strange things like intestines and such, and lungs to be able to ingest. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. And the reason is that diffusion is through a surface, which is a squared function, and the metabolism and the need for oxygen or food is based on the weight, which is a cubic function. So again, if the weight goes up, then the surface has to go up even faster.
So what would this mean for the giants of that Gulliver visited? We've talked about their strength and how heavy they would have to be. What would happen to them?
Well, I haven't really thought about it. It's a good question, and I think that probably the giants will have more lung surface. In fact, they must have more lung surface. But this might give them a different. Not only would they have elephant legs, but they might have huge barrel chests to accommodate the increase in the lung size.
So they would have to have a giant number of blood vessels and digestive systems,
right,
and things.
Right, absolutely.
And that maybe their guts would be huge then. You just couldn't simply, you know, scale them up.
Yeah, exactly right.
So you have also said that an elephant, in your book, needs less energy per ounce of flesh than a mouse. Why is this so?
Well, It's because it's a hard question to answer in a simple way, let me put it this way, that if the organism is big, like an elephant, then it must do all the things like move and breathe and heartbeat and so forth and so on. But if it did and metabolize, or in other words, consume food and turn it into energy, but if it didn't do this at a slower rate than a mouse, then it would literally get hotter and hotter. And so you can imagine an elephant or a cow bursting into flames if it had the rate of consumption of oxygen and the rate of consuming food that a mouse does. So that one way of dealing with that problem is just to do everything more slowly.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking with John Bonner, author of Why Size Matters, From Bacteria to Blue Whales. It's a beautiful, elegant book-length meditation on the role of size in determining the shape, speed, and abundance of all life forms. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. So let's talk about another aspect of organisms and size. What about speed and size? Are they related at all?
Which size?
Speed and size.
Seed.
Speed.
S-E-E-D.
No, S-P-E-E-D. Speed. The rate at which it moves.
Sorry, I'm still maybe not sure what the word is.
The rate at which they move.
Oh, speed.
Speed,
oh, sorry,
yes.
Sorry about that. That's really interesting because there's a famous physiologist, British physiologist, who actually I met years ago, a charming man called A.V. Hill. And he made the point that that if one animal is 10 times bigger than another, then it will take one step while the smaller animal takes 10 steps. Mm-hmm. So that he said, theoretically, they should actually go at the same speed. If they're constructed in an identical fashion, well, of course, no two animals are constructed in identical fashion. So he looked up racing records for greyhounds and horses and found that they're fairly close in their speed. This horse is a little faster, but not much. And so this was the initial argument about this, which really got everybody thinking about it. Well, it turns out that if you measure the speed of everything from a bacterium to the fastest swimmers or tuna fish, and the fastest flyers are things like geese and swans, and the fastest runners are cheetahs, of course. It is absolutely clear that if you plot all these animals on length versus speed, that the bigger they are, the faster they are. And the interesting thing to me always has been is that those curves converge around 1 meter. So it means that if you're 1 meter long and you're a great flyer or swimmer or runner, you run about the same speed.
So how about microscopic things? When we look at them through a microscope, they look like they just zip along. Is that what's really happening?
Well, no. Something that I didn't realize for a long time until I began to grow up, because I thought they were, because you look at them through the microscope, and they seem to be whizzing around at a tremendous speed. You look at paramecium, or even a bacterium seems to be going awfully fast. Well, suddenly one day it struck me as something that everybody else knew, of course, but I just didn't catch on, is that you look through the microscope, you change the distance. You increase the magnification. And speed is distance over time, miles per hour. So if you magnify the distance, then it'll look as though it's going very much faster, but that's only because of the microscope distorting the distance. The appearance of microbes through a microscope is very deceptive.
So what is life really like then for a microbe in terms of motion?
Well, the interesting thing about that is that as you get smaller, and we're now talking almost exclusively of swimmers in a fluid, mm-hmm. if you get smaller, then it suddenly becomes very important how viscous the fluid is, and B, your inertia. And let me explain those things. In the first place, the viscosity thing is not applicable, really, because we're talking always about water. So a big fish swims mm-hmm. in water, and so does a bacterium. Mm-hmm. So the viscosity is the same. Well, then we got to worry about it when it's.
Let's define viscosity here. Something like molasses, which
yeah,
flows
that's
very
a high,
slowly.
That's good. That's mm-hmm. good because that has a high velocity, and water has much much less. And then there are some fluids like ether or something of that sort, which are very even less viscous. Mm-hmm. But all swimming organisms, water is their medium. Mm-hmm. And so that is one thing that they have to contend with. The other is inertia. Now, inertia is something that, think of it this way. If you have a big fish or a whale, it stops swimming, then it's going to keep going for a while. In fact, for quite some while. But now if a bacterium or paramecium stops swimming, you stop it dead in its tracks, then it will have very much less inertia. So it'll still go forward, but a very small amount. Mm-hmm. You're living in a really entirely different world. And the Nobel physicist Purcell wrote a very nice article about this, because he said that as far as bacteria goes, it's like a human being swimming in a tub of very thick molasses. Mm-hmm. And then he says that now if you assume that he moves his arms about the rate of a clock minute hand does this at that speed, then you have the same, you have a good analogy of what the bacterium is faced with. And of course, we're not going to get very far in that tub of molasses, and it's, the whole thing is extremely slow.
So he described it as slow, majestic, and regular.
That's right. That's right.
Correct? Okay. And what is the relationship then between lifespan and size? Is there any relationship?
Well, yes, and that's a very interesting thing, because it is absolutely true that big animals live longer than small ones. And just look among mammals. Something like a shrew or a mouse, it probably only lives 1 year or at the most 2 years for some mice. But now, something really interesting, because in a recent newspaper article and in journals too, there was a whale, that, I guess it came up on the beach, and it had a harpoon stuck in its head region. And they were able to identify when this harpoon was made. And it was made 125 years ago. So they know the whale was at least that old, may have been considerably older. So there's nice evidence that really big things do live for a long time.
So is that a typical lifespan for a whale, or was that an extraordinary?
Well, we don't know. You see, okay. I mean, we really only have good information about much smaller animals. So, and particularly ones that can keep in zoos. So we know how for instance, that some animals are really quite long lived for their size. Parrots, for instance, last a long time. Elephants last a long time too, but they're huge, much bigger than a parrot.
And what is a long time for an elephant? 70 years?
Yes, something of that sort. But it's probably between 40 and 70. And the other interesting thing about size and longevity is that human beings last much longer than you would have predicted on the basis of their weight. But why that is so is unclear, and this is before all the modern medicine. Obviously, that helps an enormous amount. So that, but even before modern medicine, that was the case.
So our lifespan perhaps was 35 years before medicine, or something like this. Is that right?
And yes.
And you're saying that if we were to plot somehow size of the animal versus lifespan, humans kind of go off of that plot a little bit, even at 35 years.
That is right? Correct.
Okay. And so what is the fundamental reason here that larger means living longer?
I think that the reason is going back to our elephant metabolism. And that is that bigger organisms are slower in their metabolism. They have a slower heartbeat. They have a slower respiration rate. Everything is slower. And so people have been interested in this, have shown that the total number of heartbeats that a shrew has is probably roughly the same as the total number of heartbeats a whale has. And that's because the metabolism is very much faster in the small beast and very much longer in the large one. And so this is always, to me, a very sort of mysterious thing that of course, it isn't exact, but in the order of magnitude, it's correct. So it doesn't mean that when we get to a certain number of heartbeats, we immediately kick over, or that a shrew does the same thing. But however, on the average, it's true.
Now, you mentioned an interesting fact in the book that surprised me. You said most things, for example, plants, fish, and reptiles, keep growing. But apparently that's not true of mammals. Is there a size reason for this, or what is the reason?
Well, it's a very interesting point. In the first place, mammals, in general, what you just said is absolutely true. And for instance, to come to human beings again, we know that that has a lot to do with our long bones, which are seal off when we're around 20, so that they no longer can get longer. And so that is the way in which the length is and the size is controlled in some mammals. But now there are other mammals, like the elephant, which actually keeps growing. So an old bull elephant really is bigger 50 years of age than he was at 30 or 20. They don't get older, larger very rapidly. It's a declining rate of increase, but however, they do. But now the real answer to your question is why? I don't know. I mean, if I thought for a grab for a Darwinian explanation, I would say that they don't want to get larger than they can handle metabolically, which is just the thing we were talking about. So in other words, if they get too large, then they might not be able to cope as well, and therefore would be eliminated. So there'll be selection for a limited size span. And to support that, there's the interesting fact that large dogs I was going to give an argument which disproves what I just said. So
I wanted to ask you about dogs. My wife is a veterinary student, and I have begun to learn certain facts about animals, and that is that large dogs don't live as long as small dogs, which is kind of the opposite to what you said. Large dogs live a shorter lifetime than small dogs, which is a little bit the opposite of what you said about from the mouse to the whale. Is there a reason for this?
Well, I can tell you why I made the mistake and started on that as an example.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason is the example. The reason is that, I mean, I'm going to put it in very simplistic terms.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is that a Great Dane or an Irish Wolfhound is, in a sense, too big for the genetic frame of the organism, which was established in the wolf ancestors. So it is not as efficient. It is overloaded with things which it cannot cope with so well. So that if you get too big, any organism gets too big, then they will presumably not fare so well, and natural selection will take over, so that the most efficient size will be the limit to which the animal grows.
Mm-hmm. So, really, this very much supports your argument in that because dogs are artificially selected, the dogs are larger than what they should be for the kind of internal mechanisms and organs that they have.
Perfect.
An animal that is that large would actually look different at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's really a human artificial selection that has done this.
Exactly. Good for you. That's exactly right.
So one of the things that you mention is abundance, which we haven't talked about. And I want to look at just a bacteria for a minute. The humans have in their gut, and let me see if I can get this right, 100,000 million trillion is the number I saw.
Well, I can't remember that.
I have it in quotes here. So
I must
have got it. 100,000 million trillion bacteria in our guts. Why is such a small life form so successful? Does size figure into this abundance?
Well, of course, the reason it's so abundant, can be so abundant, is because of its size. And they are, of course, being selfish and getting a lot of food and all that stuff, but they also are very important to us because they produce things which are important in our diet. However, the only reason that there are so many is because they're so small.
Mm-hmm. So, abundance and size are then related. This is not an abnormality. I mean, is it larger is fewer, smaller
well,
is
it's
more?
Well, it's a generalization that's found true in all sorts of situations. So if you go out in nature, go around anywhere in the woods or on the fields around Urbana, then what you will find is that there are lots and lots of mice, but they're probably only one or two big mammals, like a deer. And it's thought that very good argument, that the reason is that the deer needs to have a bigger area to live in because he needs that area to provide him sufficient food, grass and foliage and so forth. While the smaller requirements of a mouse, even is very much less food will satisfy him. So, as a consequence, just the carrying capacity of the land means that small organisms can manage in small space, and large organisms need a big space just to get enough food.
Mm-hmm. This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with John Bonner, a biologist from Princeton. We're talking about how size determines nearly everything in a plant or animal. It's size, shape, and as we just learned, abundance. John is the author of Why Size Matters, From Bacteria to Blue Whales. It's an elegant meditation on the role of size in determining the shape, size, and abundance, as I said, of life forms. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. So I want to know now, how does size affect the sound of a living object? Is there a relationship?
Between what?
Sound and size.
Oh, yes. Well, some years ago, there used to be some records of whale songs, beautiful these long, soulful moans and groans and so forth. And some clever person decided to try and speed them up. And they sound just like bird sounds. They sound like a small titmouse or a little chirping noises. And the reason is that, of course, A, the vocal cords are very much larger in a large animal, so the sounds are lower, one. And the other is that the metabolism is lower, as we've already said a couple of times. And so as a result of that, the rate at which you put the song out is longer in big animals and shorter in small animals. So that this means that there are communication between large animals, which can be quite different. And, of course, the beautiful example is Katie Payne's discovery that elephants make noises that we can't hear. They're so low.
Well, let's talk about Katie Payne. What did she notice that made her think the animals were making noises?
Well, she was in the zoo, and she saw animals flapped around their mouths, the jowls were flapping, and she thought, "What are they doing that? What's going on?"
And these were elephants that she was watching.
Elephants. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Not chickadees. Mm-hmm. She got a recording device and found that these were noises, the sounds that were being given off by the elephant that we can't hear. And then she's done these wonderful studies, along with a number of colleagues, actually trying to find out what elephants are saying to one another in Africa.
Mm-hmm. And so she was able to play those back slowly like the whales and actually hear the sounds they were making. Is that right?
That's right. Well, can you see, once you record it, you can then convert it to frequencies that we can hear.
Mm-hmm. And these low frequencies, does that allow them to be heard a short distance or a long distance?
I'm sorry. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's the thing that's so remarkable about them, both for whale songs and for elephant songs. They go miles. And I think that the way to think of it is that thunder also can travel for miles, and it has many low notes in thunder, and so it travels tremendous distances.
Mm-hmm. John, we have a caller, and I want to turn to that caller. So we have a caller in Tuscola, Illinois. So the caller on line 4, please go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. I was wondering about a hybrid animal.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like hybrids are a superior animal to a purebred, and I was curious whether why there isn't more of that in nature. I'll hang up.
Okay. John, did you hear that question?
I did. At the very end, do hybrids exist in nature?
Yes, the hybrid animals.
Yeah. Oh, and indeed they do. And there are many, many examples of two populations of birds, say, in which where those two populations meet the borderline, you find quite a few hybrids. And it's also very good evidence that this is quite a very common thing. Now, I don't know any examples, though, where you get a hybrid involving a small animal and a large animal. It would be very interesting if you did, and presumably then if they were under selection, under Darwinian selection, then either the small size, the large size, or the intermediate size would be the most successful.
Now, John, we've also had a question from a caller electronically who asked, is there an audio version of this book available?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
No. I don't think there is.
Okay. So the book is from Princeton University Press. I will note
that's
that.
That's right. That's right.
So I want to return a little bit to that sound that we talked about, sound and size. You mentioned two bat species in your book that use infrared to echolocate their prey. And one bat emits a higher sound and one bat emits a lower sound. And what is this, first of all, how does this help them detect different prey? And secondly, what is this doing to the bats evolutionarily?
Okay, well now, in the first place, all that wonderful work of Donald Griffin and so forth showed that bats are constantly emitting, when they're feeding, a high frequency sonar, which they send out. And this sound is reflected on their prey, and so they can gauge where the prey is and how big it is, so that they don't try and swallow something enormous. And the other thing about it is that the higher the frequency, the more effectively it zeroes in on small insects, which the bats are eating, and the lower frequencies for the larger ones. Now, this particular species of bats have both large and small individuals, and as we've said earlier, the larger individuals have longer vocal cords, and so their sonar noises, we still can't hear them. They're still too high frequency for us to hear, but they're better adapted to finding bigger insects, and the smaller species or subspecies is finding the smaller insects. So it's a very nice story of where size has produced two populations, and presumably, ultimately, those populations could turn into separate species.
So you've gotten to an evolutionary driving force, and that really leads me to the fundamental point of your book, and that is that in evolution, through natural selection, size rules all. And in the time life has been on Earth, we have moved from having only life the size of bacteria to the great diversity that you mentioned at the top of the hour, microbes to 100-ton blue whales. Now, throughout the hour, you've pointed out some of the negatives to a life form getting larger. So my question is, why is there a selection or evolutionary pressure to get larger?
Oh, well, I think that the answer to that question is very straightforward. In nature, there are size niches. And so if the small organism in one of those niches disappears, then the organisms that are smaller or larger will change their size so that they'll fill that niche. Now, that just said, though, that means that you can get bigger or smaller, depending upon what's available in the environment. What's desirable in the environment, and which direction selection pushes you in. But now, that is not true for the biggest organisms, because there is no competition from something bigger. It is the biggest. Mm-hmm. So that the maximum size organisms really don't have any competition that is bigger than they are by definition.
Okay. So what you're pointing out here is that size is not really a product of evolution, but it's a major player.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the thing that drives it.
Well, you call it the prime mover of evolution. Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by this? Can you give me some examples of this?
Well, I think that almost all the things we've talked about are examples. Mm-hmm. That if you change the size, then you've got to change the shape. You've got to change the complexity. You've got to do all these other things. So in that sense, it is the size which does the first thing. It does the first push.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying here, if I understand you, is that size encourages and exploits innovation in structures. All right? So that you have to have the building blocks in order to be able to evolve.
Yes.
Can you give me an example, like the vascular tissue in small stocks? How did that lead to something else in plants?
Well, in the whole business of innovation and how you get something new, I think of it as not you mustn't think of size does that. Mm-hmm. What size does is to make something bigger. And in order for that bigger organism to survive effectively, it will have all sorts of mutations. And some of them might lead to a device or to a change which makes them able to cope with that bigger size more effectively than its brothers or sisters. Mm-hmm. So that the innovation really comes through mutation and selection. But the thing that prods it in a new direction is size.
And so one of your main contentions in the book is that size is the supreme determinant of what any organism can be or can do. Yet size is often overlooked by the scientific community. Why do you think this is so?
Oh, well, that's because organisms are more fun than rulers. And just think of an elephant, for instance. You say an elephant is big. Well, that's not very interesting. What's interesting about it is all its way is made up, its trunk, its and the fact that it's big is sort of a sideline. But what I'm saying is that the way of thinking about it is, because we're biologists and therefore are interested in everything about the elephant, we tend to forget that the elephant really is that way because there was a selection for an increase in size.
Now, John, we have about 2 minutes left here, and I want to bring up something in the book that I thought was fascinating, and that's this. You are a specialist in slime molds. What is a slime mold, and why does it fascinate you?
Oh, I can tell you that. Only 2 minutes is bad. I still need 4 hours. However, the thing about slime molds is that they are social amoebae. They're amoebae in the soil, and instead of just staying a separate amoebae, they come together and form little tiny little fruiting bodies. And there are two or three things about that that are unique. One is they feed first as separate amoebae, and then they come to form the fruiting body. And the second thing is that the fruiting body sticks up in the air on the surface of the soil, and there's very good evidence that that's to disperse the spores. So that's the way it gets other places, just mm-hmm. the way seed is dispersed in a tree. Mm-hmm. And the idea of having a social organism that's that simple is the thing that makes it so appealing and the reason I devoted my life to them. Although at the end of my career as a slime mold biologist, I have decided one thing I can say, and that is they're not as simple as I thought.
And one of the things I remember that you liked about them was that you can start a slime mold experiment on Monday, and it's done by what time? How many generations?
Well, it says, I think, Friday, but I think it should be Thursday.
Is that right? All right. Well, John, wonderful. Thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and you had some very good questions.
Excellent. Well, I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with John Bonner, author of Why Size Matters, From Bacteria to Blue Whales. The technical director for this segment was Jason Croft, and the producer was Harriet Williamson. And thanks to Liz Patton at Princeton University for engineering the ISDN connection.